Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Design a Seaplane Carrier at the Cost of £500,000. Mr. Bill O'Sullivan describes the RAN seaplane carrier HMAS Albatross from her construction to her demise at the shipbreakers.
I must admit that with the greatest of reluctance I confirm that I was a member of the crew which went across in 1938 to exchange Albatross for Hobart, and it is with the greatest of reluctance that I admit to being a member of the crew in December 1929, but that rather ages me, so I hope nobody will mention it to any of my girlfriends. The Albatross, as Lou has said, was different things to different people, but to all of us it was something that had never been seen before in any country, and there was never a repeat. There had been 11 previous albatrosses, and this one was born as a result of the fact that after the government had had built in England, because of the extreme cost of having ships constructed in Australia, the Australia and the Canberra, and through having them built overseas, they saved £1 million. And just at this time, not so very long before the Depression, £1 million was something that they had to use with the greatest discretion, and the greatest discretion necessitated employing the dockyard in Sydney to build the ship. It was a political necessity forced on the government primarily by the opposition pressures, plus the fact that, as I say, the dockyard was entirely unemployed. And so on this basis alone, Albatross was started and built here. And as I say, there'd never been another ship like her, nor was there one later. As a matter of fact, she was obsolete when she was launched. But despite that, she served many purposes, and during the war, did some amazing things. She was a cumbersome ship, she was awkward looking, she rolled like the devil, and we all remember something special about each ship. Those of us in the Navy have been on many ships and remember something special. I have never forgotten in those 49 and a half years the day we sailed through Sydney Head, turned south towards Hobart, I as a brand new OD, was on my knees in the quarterdeck facing aft, holy stoning. Thank God they don't do that now. And as the ship turned to go south, she rolled, she tossed, she pitched. And of course, looking aft, I saw the stern coming up, and for the first four or five times, it was unison. The stern came up, my tummy came up. The stern went down, the tummy went down. And this happened for five occasions, and then after that, the ship went down alone. And from there on, I was so seasick, I shall never forget my first day on Albatross. It was a disillusioning of a young fellow who was looking forward to a life of adventure, because there's nothing as disillusioning as to find yourself leaning over the guardrail with everybody saying, poor bugger. Glad they're not there themselves. Actually, Prime Minister Stanley Bruce was a fellow who sent a very inadequate cable to the Admiralty, and in it he said that it was politically desirable that a seaplane carrier be built in Australia with a speed of 21 knots and at a cost of $1 million. Now, if you've got those instructions, it'd be hard to build a ship to those specifications. And as a matter of extreme interest, I have here a note sent by him on this particular subject, the seaplane carrier Albatross, in which he states, "It must have been about 1924 or 25 that Admiralty received a cable from Australia saying, 'It is politically desirable that a seaplane carrier be built in Australia at a cost not exceeding £450,000 if built in the United Kingdom.' It was then accepted that the price would be about £1 million if built at Cockatoo Island because of the lack of skilled shipyard workers. So for the first and only time," and this is from Stephen Payne, "I had to design a ship around a price and get what I could out of the money. Australia asked for a seaplane, not an aeroplane carrier. After one or two preliminary shots, I soon saw that three hulls containing three seaplanes each, eight seaplanes total, would be as much as I can get for £450,000 sterling. As Australia stipulated, she must have 21 knots, and that meant a powerful machine. The design of the crane was tricky because they were high up and top weight, and this was a big problem. Australia House had a nice chap named Woolnough, whom I saw every week, and balancing planes and the machines, very necessary for 21 knots, and the top weight of the cranes was a problem. Woolnough and I solved fairly easily. He knew about cranes. The main difference in the hull from standard UK practice was cutting out Smith's work in framing her midship section, and it looked like this," and he gives you the shape with no curve on your side. "Nowadays, plenty of tankers are just straight boxes, but Albatross had to have a good curve of areas. I maintained the straight framing as far fore and aft as I could, but of course, at the ends, I just had to have curved frames. I believe many of them would have made a UK smithery, would have been made in a UK smithery and shipped out. I loved seeing the ship early in 1941 in Singapore Naval Base." That's the first time that he saw it, 1941 in Singapore as the HMS Albatross, when through his capacity it had been constructed in Australia in 1928. A long time to wait to see the result of your workmanship. At this time, as I say, we were close to the Depression, and so this ship, which was designed by Stephen Payne, known as the Constructor Extraordinary, and in one of the earlier journals as a story of him, which shows the amazing fellow he was and the tremendous work he did in various areas of the world. And he, of course, was, as I say, the father of our good friend, Alan Payne, who has been of tremendous assistance to me in unearthing a great deal of information. And you would also have the same experience. When you decide you're going to look through photographs to find something you know is there, you never get to that damn thing for quite a long time after, because as you're going through, you see so many things that attract your interest. And so it has been in this research job, which say it should take X hours, it's taken X plus Y plus Z, because all these fascinating things that one comes across. Now, this ship was to be part of the Australian five-year development plan, which was running from 1924 to 29, and which, as I say earlier, had included the construction of the Australia and Canberra, and also the two submarines, the Oxley and Otway. And these ships were all subject to the Washington Treaty tonnage limitations. And so the Australian camp, I think 10,000 tonnes, and this had to be taken into consideration with Albatross, keeping it within the weight limits too. So as a result of the progress made by Stephen Payne, who already had a tremendously heavy load of work in the dockyards of England, when the government told him that they were ready to roll, they had the money ready, then he had his initial part ready to be placed down. And on the 16th of April 1926, the hull of the ship was laid down at Cockatoo Dock. And then the job continued until completion with plates and sections sent out from UK. As Stephen was working them out on paper there, having them constructed and sent out to Australia to build the ship. And as I say, didn't even see what it looked like until so many years after. And this went on then until February 1928, at which time he was ready to move out of dock. So at this time also, in the various records I have searched, it revealed that the ship was launched by the same lady, but on three separate days, they being the 21st of February 28, the 23rd of February 28, and the 24th of February 28. But I think I'm quite safe in taking the Navy Office record, which gives the date as the 21st of February 1928. And if you remember the date on which Bert Hinkler arrived in Australia on his first solo flight from England, it was the day after that. Now, the launching was by Lady Stonovan, the wife of the Governor General. And it was on the 21st of December that the ship was completed and accepted, having recorded the speed of 22.5 knots as against the 21 required, with 12,910 horsepower in her trials. Some statistics, she had a displacement of 4,800 tonnes, an overall length of 443 feet 9 inches, a beam of 58 feet and a 16 foot 6 draft. She'd been fitted with anti-torpedo bulges, which added to her breadth, making it a total of 60 feet 9 inches. And the cost, out of the $1 million, they got a bit of change in the ship. It cost £941,000 Australian, but a further £260,000 was required for the armament. And the armament on the Albatross consisted of four 4.7 anti-aircraft guns, two 2-pounders, and four 3-pounder quick-firing saluting guns. And the ship was the home for a total of 450 officers and men, including the RAAF. As a matter of fact, it was rather strange that the RAAF got on board, because the Marshal, when he heard casually in newspaper and other areas that they were building a seaplane carrier, he said, well, who's going to supply the planes? And they said, you are. It was the first he'd heard of it. They hadn't consulted him or his men on the type that could be used there. They just built the ship. And then he was advised that he was required to supply the planes. They started off with 450 crew, but later on in the Depression, 1930, they had to reduce costs everywhere, and so it was reduced to 350, fluctuated from there on. They had portholes, and I should imagine that they had given consideration to giving the sailors oars to poke out through them to save an engine, but it was decided she was a bit heavy, and so she was fitted with Parsons geared turbines with two shafts, 12,000 horsepower, and four Yarrow boilers. Her top deck had no shear, and the frames above the turn of the bilge were straight here again, as we mentioned earlier, for the sake of economy. And the price, of course, didn't include aircraft, and this later on had to be added cost. when they became available. No catapults. This was costly, and apart from that, the planes they had were wooden structure, and they couldn't have stood the strain of being catapulted off. So it was not until 1936 that a catapult was fitted. And she started off then with six Supermarine Seagulls Mark III, and they had wooden hulls, as I say, hadn't been strengthened for catapulting, and it was not until they got the catapult and replaced those planes with Seagull Mark V that the catapult could be used. She had bays to accommodate nine seaplanes, but she only had six, here again, economy. And they, of course, had to be passed overboard with the three cranes. They would be hooked on, lowered over the side, or hooked on and brought inboard. And they couldn't be hooked on if the weather was at all inclement, or if the sea was the least bit choppy. Or in the frequently around Tasmania, we'd have to follow the planes into the bay to bring them back again, get them on board. Now, to get them on board, they were then placed on the deck, and from there they had to get into their bays in the hangar. And the entry to the hang was by means of an opening, a large hatch cover, an oblong fitting, slid back under the bridge, leaving the hole through which they entered the hangar. And of course they were subject to any breaks in the weather. They had to be got in very quickly, got out very quickly, tied down, secured. And she was really a fair weather, peacetime ship. And many occasions, I say, the plane just couldn't leave the ship because the weather wasn't suitable. So after Lady Sonovan had launched the ship and she was ready for commissioning, Captain Denham Bedford, RN, was appointed first captain. And on the 23rd of January 1929, she was commissioned and took her out on trial down to Tasmania. I didn't go down for the next trip, and around Victorian ports, running the ship in, breaking the crew in, and so she became part of the RAN squadron, exercising with the other ships to get the feel of being part of our Navy. She had various episodes, and as usual, joined the others in Hobart for the regatta. She'd come back to Sydney for leave, winter leave, go north for the winter cruise, come back to Sydney for summer leave after having been to Melbourne for the cup. And of course, this was the routine for a number of years, and it was a very pleasant existence, especially the winter cruise up north amongst the islands. She had a magnificent deck for sunbaking. She also had a magnificent deck for deck hockey, and I don't know how many fellows had how many pieces of flesh dug out by the deck bolts. They were placed everywhere, of course, because when the planes came in, boy, they had to be tied down. But many, many battles of deck hockey took part on that ship's deck. She was a fine ship for that, if for nothing else. So after they could, before they went away to Hobart in 1930, I, as I say, had joined them as a brand new OB December 29, and we left at the end of January to go to Hobart. And of course, taking part in the regatta, all sorts of tricks were got up to. On the way down, of course, we stopped at Jarvis Bay. Lots of fishing, lots of running along the beach, and lots of night manoeuvres and exercises, etc. And it was just about this time I joined in April 29, went to sea at the end of 29, and it was at this time, when I was in depot actually, that the Depression struck. And those of you who can go back that far will recall how there were always so many sailors discontented. We used to sail on for 12 years in those days. And they used to be getting around grunting and groaning and saying, "Roll on my so-and-so 12. But when the Depression hit Australia, they didn't say it so loudly. In fact, they stopped saying it, because it was very obviously that the outside world was not nearly as attractive as it had been. There was a tremendous amount of unemployment and disasters were taking place. And I remember a number who did get out. I'm thinking particularly of three petty officers. They were jolly glad to come back as ABs, because the world outside was a bitter place. And it really cured a lot of grumbling and discontent, but it's hard to have that sort of thing happen to make them realise that the Navy wasn't such a bad place after all. As a matter of fact, at the Coral Sea Day march the other day, I was in front of the Hobart group, and our Admiral Guy Griffiths came across. I always think it's a compliment when a fellow who knows so many and is as busy as he is and meets everybody came across and said, "Hello, Bill, lovely to see you again. You know, remember a name." And if he just said, "I think I know that place," well, you could accept this, that we've been good friends to our ship for a long time. Then the General came along and we were speaking. I said, "Well, of course, we can't all be lucky enough to be in the Navy." And the General thought it mightn't be. So he said, "Well, I might dispute that. I suppose having been in the Army long enough to become a General, you have some attraction for it." Then, as I say, we left the Depression behind us, accepting that there were many, many economies. And off I went to sea. I must mention too also that not for a reward for having launched the ship, but Lord and Lady Donovan, in the year 1929, went on the first vice-regal visit to New Guinea and the surrounding islands. And I could imagine that this would have been a very interesting and a very enjoyable cruise for them. So anyhow, the ship came back to Sydney in August 29 after that cruise, and Captain Bedford stayed on, took the ship again off to Tasmania and Victorian ports. Down in Tasmania this year, one of the planes crashed, and the pilot observer were killed, and also the signalman, a fellow named Don McGowan. Bob will be interested to know he was an ex-Tingara boy, Don McGowan, given a full service military funeral in Hobart City. I came across that when I was going through my snaps. So having been down to Victoria and Tasmania, the ship then went up to Brisbane to go north on our island cruise, and here we lost our captain. And Captain Harry Feakes took over. Harry was later promoted to Rear Admiral, but during his time on board, he was a personality. So many people are personalities in their own time. Harry was a personality. I remember he was a friend of Melba's. He used to do a lot of singing himself. You'd find him wandering around the quarterdeck singing his heart out. Created a problem for one of our motorboat drivers one day. Harry would stand in the stern seats of the boat going ashore, singing, and on this particular occasion, he was standing up there and remembered suddenly he'd forgotten something. So instead of saying to the coxswain, "Return to the ship," he started singing, "Coxswain, return to the ship, coxswain, return to the ship," and they were used to him and they just ignored him. So the coxswain didn't return to the ship, and ultimately Harry stopped singing and gave a direct order. So the coxswain returned to the ship, and when he came back again, he was on the quarterdeck with his hat off. So many of us have been on the quarterdeck with our hat off. But this was one of Harry's little foibles. He'd sing things, and if you weren't musically inclined or weren't expecting that he was giving you a message, you just didn't get the message. One thing I noticed about Harry Feakes, he had been the captain of the old Parramatta when it was a unit of the Commonwealth Naval Forces in 1910, before the RAN was formed. So there's a man who was older than me. Harry had his times. of stress like the rest of us. On one occasion, going alongside the wharf of Hobart, and he found he had too much weigh on, and we were heading up towards Constitution Dock. So he gave the order, drop both anchors, and they dropped both anchors, which would have been all right, excepting that the bloody wharf was alongside the port anchor and it crashed onto it. Which didn't enhance his prestige of seamanship with the local authorities. However, he just sung it off. After he had joined us in Brisbane in August 1930, we continued our cruise to the islands. And one of the activities we engaged in there, we stopped on the spot where Captain James Cook on the Endeavour Reef had gone aground and had to cast everything over the side, including his armament. And we sent our divers down to look for it. Didn't find anything, but we had an interesting time. Of course, in those days, they had the hard hat divers. The other fellows might have been able to move further around and perhaps find something, but we spent several days there looking for Captain James Cook's jettison guns, but we didn't find them. We came back south then, and on the 3rd of August 31, Captain Feakes, still a popular man when he left, turned over his command to Captain C.J. Pope. He'd taken us around to Adelaide before he paid off, and somebody was saying recently that the Albatross never went across the Bight because they couldn't trust it. Really, looking back through the records, I find that on three occasions we got to Adelaide and we couldn't submerge, though we tried to probably, so we must have gone across the Bight. And that was as far as we went until later on we went around to the west. Storm blew up, and I remember, I don't know if the ship rolled 135 degrees or only 35 degrees, but she went over so far we didn't think we'd get back. The bookie on board was laying the odds to that. In fact, hanging on to his money in case we didn't get back there. And so we then took Captain Pope on board and then down to Melbourne for the Cup, down to Tasmania for the regatta. Now remember, we had on board a lieutenant who was a young fellow who loved the ladies and believed they loved him. And he'd do anything more or less, as some people would say, I don't care a bugger what they say about me as long as they say something. And my old friend Vivian Mallison, he was always up to some trick. On this occasion, he entered the boat in the boat race, the all-comers race, the last one after all of the other races had been run. He took the second cutter, manned it with a powerful crowd of fellows. But they weren't stroking very hard as they moved along and slowly got ahead of the other boats. And he won the race. He was standing up there on his fore and aft rig, full dress. And it was not until he had to take his boat alongside the flagship to be awarded and congratulated that he said to the stoker who was running the engine, turn off and stand up. Of course, when the Admiral saw that, he lost. He didn't really win the race. But it was a good trick, that. Good ship Christmas parties alongside Garden Island. Here I came across some snaps where we had a flying fox from the up above the bridge down to the bows, and the ship was full of kids and having lots of fun. Another thing about this Vivian Mallison, when we were in harbour, he'd always take some beautiful young lady sailing on the Saturday afternoon or Sunday. If he was duty watch, he'd always bring one aboard, and on this particular day, on the quarter deck, with his lipstick under his arm and the beautiful young lady sitting on the bollard cover, young signalman came along, entered the quarter deck, saluted, handed a message to Lieutenant Mallison, saluted, turned around and wandered off. So Mallison thought, this is a good way to impress my girl, so he called him back and he gave him a blast for not signalling as he left the officer. So he said, you will stand here and salute me 100 times. Well, this was all right, excepting for the kid. But Big Bill Stewart came up the hatch onto the quarter deck And he said, "What's going on?" So Malvern told him, "He said, good, I agree with the punishment." He said, "But you'll remember that in KO and II, King's Rules and Admiralty Instructions, when an officer is saluted, he must return the salute." "We will therefore continue. You will start saluting again, ordinary signal and so on, so 100 times. And there's Mallison saluting Madeline, his girl, laughing. But still, can't win them all, I suppose. One thing I remember about the period when Captain Pope was in control there, one day Mrs. Pope, who was more of a captain than he was, she'd see something hanging over the ship's side. She went aboard the Australia one day, called for the captain, and she told him of her complaint. There was something hanging out the porthole. So the captain of Australia thought this wasn't such a good idea. So he called for the officer of the day. He said, "Call away the motorboat, escort Mrs. Pope to the boat. She's going ashore." And I don't know if he heard any more about it after that, but that's what happened that day. This then brought Captain Pope to the end of his term of office, and the ship was not in commission for very much longer, because our old friend Captain Harry Houghton, who we learned to love in Hobart, he took over then, temporarily in charge, and the ship was only in commission for a month. He joined her in March, and she paid off in April 33. I always remember Harry. He was known as Collar and Cuffs. Didn't have any money till he married some. His cuffs were always very, very stiff. His collar was very stiff. He's like me, a runt of a bloke, but a tremendous man, despite his size. And his collar and cuffs were always very, very stiff and very, very frayed. So they called him Collar and Cuffs. But he was a tremendous fellow. And as I say, later on he became our very favourite captain. And then on the 26th of April 1933, the ship paid off into reserve. And for 5 years then, she swung around the buoy or leaned against Garden Island, because the country couldn't afford to run her. They had no special use for her. Other little things that happened during that life of the ship. When Kingsford Smith came out, coming over Western Australia, he was lost. And so amongst other rescue efforts that were started, the Albatross was in Sydney at the time. Her crew were all recalled to go and join in the search. But by the time they got over towards the Bight, the plane had been located, so she wasn't needed. So she came back and carried on with leave. Another very interesting occasion was Francis Chichester, the fellow who recently went around the world on his own in the boat and was knighted. He flew solo from New Zealand, landed in Jervis Bay, where we were at the time, with Australia, brought his seaplane down, and it was too rough for him to take off again, so Australia's motorboat brought him alongside. They were going to send somebody down to hook on for him, but he insisted on doing it himself. And it was difficult even for the experts who were familiar with our hooking on process, and so he lost a finger, crushed his hand. But he got his seaplane inboard, and as I say, he was damaged, and the weather was inclement, so we were coming back to Sydney, so he came with us. And then he flew on to Japan. Tremendous fellow. What else have we got here? Yes, during that time she'd visited 160 ports of call between the 23rd of January 28 and the 26th of April 33. All around Australia, New Guinea and the islands, and all very interesting for us fellows when we weren't seasick. So that then took her out of her first commission, and as they say, she swung around the buoy, leaned against the island for 5 years. Then as part of the naval program, the second commission, resulted from the naval program having a provision for two additional cruisers to be supplied to us in 1938, and the Albatross was to be part payment for one of them. So she was recommissioned, I joined her, and so I took her over, with a few hundred others, of course. The mess decks filled the hangar, a very big space, of course, 9 bays, and of course extra crew. So the mess deck was full, the hangar was full of messes, and we had quite a calm trip all the way, actually. I remember on one occasion there, you always find fellows who are not really bright, I'm one of them, but this particular fellow I'm thinking of, he was a very strong fellow, and he could throw a bag of wheat over his shoulder and pick up the double with it. So I said to him one day, he was a chap who was always pantry hand or something like that, he just couldn't be trusted with any responsibility. Said to him one day, "Look, Bill, you're a strong fellow. What do you weigh?" "Oh, I weigh 12 stone. "You could lift somebody weighing 12 stone, couldn't you?" He said, "I could lift one under each arm." He said, "Look, come along. We want you to experiment with something. We're talking about the force of gravity, how it affects certain things." And so they had one of these round wooden mess deck tubs with a handle on each side, and they stood Billy in it, and they said, "Look, Bill, you can lift more than 12 stone, and you're only 12 stone. You just show us how you lift yourself." And this poor bloody Bill, tugging to try and lift himself off the ground. But gravity won. Takes all sorts, doesn't it, eh? Edwin Darwin. And I have a photo showing we arrived in Darwin towing the Hanko. I don't know how or why, but I know she was there when we arrived in Darwin and we left her there. Then on to Singapore. By the time we reached Singapore, there was a measles epidemic on board, and so our adventure in Singapore, we got ashore, they found us a hot tin shed in which we stood around for a couple of hours drinking hot tin beer, and were glad to go back aboard again. Then on to Colombo, by which time we were able to go ashore, and the Gullface Hotel and the Navy House and a few other places saw us there. Then on to Aden, through Suez, Portside and Gibraltar. Then on to Devonport, we arrived on the 8th of September 38. And there we berthed alongside the Apollo, which was to be the Hobart. I think we might at this stage just show a couple of our slides to let the audience see what the ship looked like. Right, now, we've arrived in England, we've got her secured alongside, and we arrived in England actually at the time of the Moonish crisis. They called up all the reserves, and in this port it was full of old sailors, long grey beards. They'd apparently come out of their hamlets and they were having a wow of a time drinking lemonade and beer, of course, and it looks like a lot of them hadn't been off the chain for years, and they're really enjoying themselves. They look really, really look sailors. But, as I say, the pressure was on. We were going to spend quite a few weeks transferring from one ship to the other, but the time was so short. Chamberlain had just come back from his visit to Hitler, waving his piece of paper, "Peace in our time," and so they recognised that there was not time just for a casual changing over. And so everybody was working very hard. Living conditions were unpleasant, very, very dockyard condition. And we noticed particularly, and I say this particularly, and I say it clearly because the sailors have always said about the RNers, we'd get piped Liberty men to clean with about 20 minutes to get cleaned and full and race down madly, have a shower. The RN fellas would come in with their going ashore suits on and their hats. They'd push their hat platter back. They'd roll their sleeves up and they'd have their bath that way. But this went on a lot, and with the shortage of water, they had an excuse. So right at the Moonish crisis time, we had a lot of fun. We worked hard. And before very long then, it was time to take over our own ship, the Apollo, as Hobart, and to let the Albatross go to the Royal Navy. One thing I particularly meant to mention on the way over too, so many of you would have enjoyed the crossing the line ceremony. We have had this, of course, and I remember when we called in at Darwin, I knew that I was going to be the maternity nurse. Can you imagine anybody more suitable? I was the assistant of the doctor in the crossing line ceremony. I was the maternity nurse, so I went up to the hospital in Darwin and told the sisters there what I had to do, and I finished up with a magnificent nurse's uniform, the whole lot, you know, white socks and white shoes. And on the crossing the line ceremony occasions, I had to, you know, keep a rear guard lookout with all these old sailors around. I was the best bit of flesh on board. It was interesting to note in, I was fortunate enough in getting a copy of the HMS Albatross crossing the line ceremony, and it was interesting to note that amongst all those officers we had on board that time, Big Bill Stewart, of course, Commander Rednell, Paymaster Commander Johns, Lieutenant Commander Liddell, and Lieutenant Vivian Mallison, the one I was telling the little stories about, Lieutenant R.I. Peake, Lieutenant Dawson, Surgeon Lieutenant Hall, Sub-Lieutenant Purvis, Paymaster Sub-Lieutenant Sharp, Commissioned Gunner Aldridge, Commissioned Gunner Lower, Lenny Lower, Commissioned Shipwright Gooch, and then Commander E. Gray, Surgeon Commander Prentice, Lieutenant Commander Freddie Cook, Lieutenant Commander Harries, Pay Lieutenant Commander O'Reilly, Lieutenant W.K. Tapp, Lieutenant Hancock, and so many of those rose to a position much above that of Captain of the Heads. We had Lieutenant I.R. Peacock, later became Vice Admiral, I.R. Peake, later became Vice Admiral Sir Richard Peake. Sub-Lieutenant I.K. Purvis became Commodore. Lieutenant Commander F.N. Cook became Captain. Lieutenant Commander V.H. Harris became Captain. Sub-Lieutenant J.M. Ramsey, now Commodore Sir James Ramsey, Governor of Queensland. And a delightful fellow. He and the Hobart boys have some gets together up there. And we had the brother of Tony Sinnott on board. And I was talking to Tony on Garden Island a few years ago, and he mentioned that the arrangement wasn't his family. The brother was going to join the Navy, and he was going to stay on as a farmer. The brother left the Navy, and Tony said, "Here I am." And for a farmer, he hasn't done very badly. A really top boy. So on the 6th of October 1938, the Albatross was commissioned in the Royal Navy as HMAS Albatross, and she went for trials to Devonport and was then placed in reserve on the 30th of November 1938. Meantime, we'd taken over the Hobart, and we were very, very busy too. But we're staying with the story of the Albatross. So instead of saying, but here ended the first lesson, this is the end of the Albatross, it wasn't, because although she spent a lot of time out of action, she spent a lot of time in action. And she lived again in periods of tension, and she contributed most worthily to the cause. From the 25th of August, 39, she was recommissioned, and with six Supermarine Walrus amphibians on board, she sailed for war service in the South Atlantic, West Africa and Madagascar, being based on Freetown. And her aircraft flew out over the Atlantic on anti-submarine and anti-radar patrols and search and rescue duties. And it was not until 1940 that a catapult was fitted. One of my fellows was telling me yesterday that he and two other Hobart fellows coming back on a special trip called into Freetown to take passage to Cape Town, and where should they find themselves but on board HMS Albatross again. Another thing that happened with the old Albatross, on one occasion she joined in the search for the German battleship Graf Spee. By Christ, that would have frightened the Graf Spee, wouldn't it? To see that looming out of here. Something else didn't frighten us, that amazed us. We were going up through the Bay of Biscay on the Albatross, and suddenly the port lookout called out,
Manly Ferry on the Port Bowser.
And of course the officer says, what the hell, what are you talking about? And it was the South Stain on the way out to Sydney, 1938. Manly Ferry on the Port Bowser, the Bay of Biscay. Boy, hadn't even been ashore.
Back in 1942 then, the Albatross went across to Mobile in USA for a refit, and she was converted to a repair ship. And on returning to England in 1943, the catapult was again removed and she was paid off until January 44, when she became a landing craft accommodation ship, as well as a repair ship at Plymouth. Well, that was rather an ignominious position for a fighting ship. And anyhow, in May 44, she was transferred to Combined Operations Command as a repair ship, and her activities included restoring 123 vessels. And her crowning glory came when she actually fought at Normandy on D-Day. And although on the 24th of June 44, she was hit by a 5.9 shell, she was repaired and back on the beaches the next month in July, and she succeeded in destroying one Junkers J-88 and two shore batteries. Having looked at that on there, Christ, you'd never think she could do anything like that, would you? And on the 11th of 9, August 1944, she was torpedoed for course hurls, losing 50 dead and 50 injured. But she didn't go down. That didn't finish her, because she was taken back to Portsmouth and repairs were started, but they were discontinued in October of that year, 1944, and she was moved to Falmouth in the reserve fleet pending disposal. And then in October 46, she was deleted from the Navy list and sold to the Southwestern Steam Company as a storage hulk. Another ignominious thing to happen to a ship. It was, however, decided to convert it to an offshore floating cabaret at Torquay on the Devonshire coast. And she was renamed the Pride of Torquay. We've got a slide there, I think, haven't we? Has the Pride of Torquay? Let's have, haven't we? Oh, good. That's right, yes. Right, they were going to make her into one of these floating gambling joints, I suppose, but the cost of that was too high, and so she was sold to the British, Greek, you know, Unalutis' Greek group of ship owners for $185,000 on the 14th of November, 48. On the day that Prince Charles was born. And as she was a unit of the China Hellenic Lines also, from Hong Kong, she was named the Hellenic Prince to honour that occasion. And this is the one we have now, if you wouldn't mind. This is the last of the slides we have, but we'll see her as the Hellenic Prince. She was then fitted up at Barry in Wales at a cost of $200,000 as a passenger ship to carry 1,000 passengers, and she had a restaurant accommodation for 500 people to sit down at once. And in 1949, and she's on the way back home, she was chartered by the International Refugee Organization, and on the 5th of December 1949, she returned to Sydney Harbour, carrying 1,000 displaced persons. She stayed on that one until 1953, when she was laid up and sold to the shipbreakers in Hong Kong on the 12th of August 1954 for £6,000. Let me see. No, I'm making it too cheap. £60,000. Now, as I say here, every ship lives on in the hearts of the men who sailed on her. And in England, her name is carried on by the HMS Albatross Association. In Australia, we have a foremast mounted on the land-based depot HMS Albatross at Nowra, which was commissioned on the 31st of August 1948 as the RAN air station. And there we have, in England, the men HMS Albatross Association, and here her name is carried on by that splendid Navy Air Force base at Nowra. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to me. I shall leave her there.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.